Welcome to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free call-in number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. Or, if you're currently, recently, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. How many people are homeless? How many people have ever been homeless? Are they really all drug addicted or mentally ill? Is it true that women and children are the fastest growing segment of the homeless population? Just how many homeless families are there? Are the numbers of homeless people going up or down? We'll take a look at what the numbers show right after this national homeless news update.
Cities across the country embarked on a homeless headcount in January, doing their part to nab millions in federal funding available through the Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD plans to allocate $1.4 billion to homelessness programs through local agencies this year. This was the first year the federal agency has tied the funding to a standardized nationwide count of people experiencing homelessness. The results will be used to decide how much money each of the thousands of local organizations will receive. Cities that do not conduct the count risk receiving fewer dollars. HUD guidelines required that cities conduct the head count in the last week of January, when shelters are full or near capacity. Counting the number of people experiencing homelessness has its complications. In Portland, Oregon, more than 50 agencies were involved in counting the number of people living on the streets. Last year, a one-night headcount of people sleeping outside in Portland, Oregon, tallied nearly 1,600 people, but people who work with the homeless estimate that closer to 4,000 people in this city are experiencing homelessness. There are fewer than 1,000 shelter beds in the city. In Chicago, local officials and advocates estimate that there are between 9,600 and 15,000 people living on the streets, with only about 6,000 shelter beds available. Previous counts in San Francisco have tallied more than 8,600 people who are homeless. The last estimate from Los Angeles County recorded 84,000 people homeless, but that was 10 years ago and it was not a head count. It was based instead on the number of people receiving public assistance. The results of the counts are not expected to be known for several weeks.
In Oregon, a statewide alliance of housing advocates rallied at the state's Capitol building demanding lawmakers help low-income Oregonians afford housing. The newly formed Housing Alliance, a coalition of 40 nonprofit Oregon organizations, used the event to push their four-point plan of legislation. They want to see new money dedicated to sustaining and creating more affordable housing. The group is asking lawmakers to increase grants from the Housing Trust Fund by $5 million and to renew and increase the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit and establish it as a revolving fund. The alliance also says creating a low-income renter's tax credit will greatly benefit families struggling to stay in housing. One of the options for funding new money for affordable housing is a real estate transfer fee. That proposal would raise funds for affordable housing through a nominal surcharge, typically a fraction of a percentage, on the sale of existing homes. Alliance members also want the state to repeal legislation that prohibits local municipalities from requiring affordable housing in future developments. According to statistics from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, housing prices in the Portland metro area have far exceeded any increase in the area's median household income. The availability of housing among families experiencing poverty is even more limited, forcing many low-income families to move outside the metro area and farther away from families, jobs, and services. According to the director of the alliance, the rising cost of housing has pushed Oregon to 44th in the nation in terms of the percentage of people who own homes.
The Nagoya, Japan municipal government on Monday, January 24th, removed the tents of homeless people in a park in the center of the city, in a move said to be connected with the opening in March of the 2005 World Exposition in Aichi Prefecture. Nagoya is the capital of the prefecture, located in central Japan, and with a population of more than 2 million, it's one of Japan's major cities. Homeless rights supporters denounced the forceful measure in frigid midwinter, saying the city government just wants to hide the homeless from public view before tourists start arriving in Nagoya for the expo. Average temperatures in Nagoya in January are slightly above freezing. The city government claimed last year that the tents prevented appropriate use of the park and maintenance work and asked the homeless people to leave. For the Homelessness Marathon, I'm Orion Gray.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Additional assistance by Joanne Zuhl, KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Nobody, and welcome back to the, my God, it's the 13th hour of the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, where the numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8, or if you're homeless, afraid you're going to be homeless or formerly homeless, you can also call in on 866-LEFT-OUT. And if anybody wants to see what's going on here at the website, you can go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org and you can see us here on the webcam. On the line, I have Dennis Culhane, who is a professor of social welfare policy at the University of Pennsylvania, and Donna Anderson, who is the director of the Institute for Children and Poverty. Donna and Dennis, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Good morning.
Is Dennis there, too? No, Dennis. All right, Donna, let's start with you. We're going to talk about numbers now. How many children in the United States at any given moment are homeless?
There are approximately 50,000 to 100,000 kids homeless at any given moment in the United States, scattered across the country in different areas, of course. The majority of the homeless population is concentrated in the Northeast, but of course there are homeless populations also in the West, the Midwest, and the South.
Mm-hmm. I just realized I forgot. Dennis isn't here because he's got to. We told him we'd come in 10 minutes later because he's taking his kids to school.
Oh, okay.
All right, so that's it. So you're saying roughly 50 to 100,000 at any moment?
Yeah.
That's a lot of kids to be homeless.
It is definitely a kid. And just in New York City itself, it's sort of where we're based here. Just last week, there were 15,000 kids living in homeless shelters in New York City.
My God. And this is the snapshot, what we call the snapshot. In the course of a year, of course,
right. There
are more because they turn over who's on the streets or who's in the shelters. How many kids are homeless in the course of a year?
There's about 1.4 million kids, the latest estimates that that I've seen. So every year, 1.4 million kids across the country
and let me ask a stupid question, but to which I know the answer, but it's worth making this point. Is it good for children to be homeless?
Indeed, it is not good for kids to be homeless. We've done numerous studies on some of the homeless populations in New York City and indeed across the country. And kids who are homeless, have been homeless, spend more time traveling to school, are left back more often, have worse grade performance, have a lot of health issues that kids who are not homeless don't have to deal with. Their health care tends to be much more focused in emergency rooms and clinics rather than going to family doctors. So there's a wide variety. They experience more domestic violence, more community violence than the average population. So there's a lot of things that there are a lot of barriers that homeless kids face. In addition to social barriers, like kids get teased if they by other kids when they find out that they're homeless, if their bus picks them up at a homeless shelter. You know, there are a lot of these social issues as well that are very difficult for kids.
Mm-hmm. So more than a million kids a year in this country are being traumatized by homelessness is the bottom line.
That's exactly right.
Right. Now, I don't know, maybe a solution would be if we could get Al-Qaeda to attack all these children, God forbid, but maybe then if the government would take it seriously, I don't know. I mean, you know, then we'd say, oh, they're attacking our kids, but somehow it's all just getting ignored.
Oh, I mean, it's sort of a... It's a difficult issue, and everyone sort of wants to help kids, but then, you know, you sort of look at these programs that are proposed, something like McKinney-Vento or the No Child Left Behind Act, and when these programs are, they're great, they're proposed, but when they're not fully funded, It's just sort of an indicator of where budgetary priorities are in mm-hmm, the government.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of children, here, fresh from seeing his children off to school, is Dennis Culhane. Dennis, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hello there, Jeremy. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing good. And, of course, Dennis, you've been here before, so it's a pleasure to be speaking to you again. Dennis, I know you're a great expert on the numbers and many other aspects of homelessness. Now, if you listen to Bill O'Reilly, he characterizes homeless people as people who can't get their lives together. Is there anything in the numbers that might contradict this in the research?
Well, vast majority of people who are homeless for very brief periods of time, and they get out of homelessness without help, without, you know, a formal program giving them a housing subsidy. So they're getting out pretty much on their own, and they don't return to homelessness. So that is good evidence, I would think, on the face of it, that most people, in fact, do pick themselves up by their own bootstraps and get out of the situation. And in fact, among families, the proportions are even higher.
What percentage of the people who become homeless would you say get out of homelessness eventually?
Probably around, and among the single adults, at least 80%. Mm-hmm. And even more than that, if you consider that even some of the folks who are more long-term homeless, they ultimately get out as well. Some, you know, through hospitalization, and some through jail, so not the nicest means, but also some through special housing programs.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that of the people who are homeless today, the vast majority of them will not be homeless this time next year.
Right. Now, of course, one thing we've discussed before, the total number of people estimate who have ever been homeless.
The total number of people who have ever been homeless. Well, I think that the only research on that was done by Bruce Link and folks at Columbia University some years back, and they, I think, estimated a lifetime prevalence rate of 12.5% of the U.S. adult population, spending time in a shelter or sleeping outdoors in a place not intended for sleeping. So that does not count people just, you know, sleeping on a couch in someone's house.
Now that would put us up over 30 million.
Of today's population, that's true. Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is the logic I use, and tell me why I'm wrong. Oh, because, you know, you're saying maybe more than 80%. But if 30 million or so have been homeless, and there's 750,000 at any given time on the street, that means that, you know, well over 96-97% of the people who were ever homeless have gotten out of it.
Yes, exactly. That would be that's one way of characterizing what I've said, and that would be correct, yes.
Okay. And would you still hold to the snapshot of about 750,000, or have those numbers changed since I last looked at them?
That's probably as good of an estimate as we have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do we see any changes in the trends? And I know we talked about this earlier, and because there's some disagreement about this. I don't know, maybe you and Donna even disagree, but I haven't asked Donna.
Who's your other guest?
Donna Anderson from the Institute on Child Poverty.
Okay, great.
I'm sorry, Institute for Children in Poverty. But your position is that the percentage of children among the homeless is not actually rising. Is that correct?
That's right. It has been said by people for many years that families are the fastest growing segment of the homeless population, but in fact the percentage of the homeless who are in families has been largely unchanged since the late 1980s.
And Donna, is that your perception or do you disagree with that?
We've seen fairly steady numbers in New York City as well.
Okay.
For the homeless population and the amount and number of kids and families.
So I'm glad, you know, because we're not alarmists here on this broadcast. You don't have to be an alarmist. It's bad enough. So, you know, this is something that's often bandied about, but it isn't necessarily true that, you know, children are the fastest growing segment or something. It's bad enough, but they are there in large numbers.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right.
Okay. Let me give those numbers out again there. 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT, and we have somebody at the microphone. Please tell us your name.
Hi, my name is Magni. I'm a student at Yale and involved with the homeless community here in New Haven, mainly through advocacy. A group called Respect Line is composed mainly of people who are homeless, but also a couple of students working on issues regarding homelessness in New Haven. I actually wanted to thank Dennis Culhane. We got him to come to New Haven in March of last year. He actually addressed some issues with length of stay policies, trends in homelessness, and people still talk about that lecture. And I had a question for him. We're talking about homeless numbers, and I was hoping he could talk about his research about length of stay policies and how those often, you know, don't really help get people get out of shelters, but maybe perpetuate homelessness by getting them into unstable living situations and having them sort of fall back into homelessness again and again.
Dennis?
Okay, sure. It was very nice to be up there last year. I remember it fondly. Well, I think that, you know, the caller makes a very good point. Many places in the United States, it's actually particularly true in the southern part of the U.S., where there is a maximum length of stay that you can be in a shelter or in a whole shelter system. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, sometimes it's a month. But various places will sometimes have a you know, strict limit that they impose on the time people can be there. And in fact, of course, people don't, as we already indicate, a lot of people are leaving homelessness on their own, but there is a definite sub-segment of the population who cannot exit homelessness without some kind of sustained support and some kind of programmatic support. And these length of stay policies for this group means they get shuttled out of one shelter into sometimes into a public location, into a park or something like that. They end up in the hospital, in the emergency room, sleeping in the library, sleeping in malls, wherever they can. And it does nothing to address their situation. So while I understand that some shelters want to make sure people don't settle in there and they want to encourage people to move on, I think people mostly want to move on because the conditions in shelters are not very nice to begin with.
Wagner, do you have another question?
Well, I mean, thank you for that comment. In New Haven, we have a 90-day length of stay policy, and it's problematic precisely because of the reasons that Dennis Culhane has been saying, and there's really not enough support for people to make it possible to get out of homelessness. There's not enough housing, there's not enough jobs, not enough case managers for 90 days to be viable. So thanks very much.
Well, before I let you go, Magna, I want to ask you something. Are you or have you ever met anybody who is a member of the Skull and Bone Society?
I don't know. You know, they're not allowed to tell us if there's a member of the Skull and Bone Society, but maybe, who knows?
So you could be a member and you wouldn't tell me.
Yes, but I'm not a member. I'm not a member of any secret society, so.
Okay. But let me ask you this. Do you see a lot of people walking around the Yale campus, and they're not saying that they belong to Skull and Bones, but they do have horns and a tail?
Of course.
Okay, so there is a clue, right?
Yes, there is a clue.
All right, thank you very much. Donna, let me ask you this. When we talk about the children who are homeless, what can you tell us about those children? What is the age range of children who are homeless? Are they more likely to be one thing or another? Who are they likely to be with?
A majority of homeless kids, at least that we find in family shelters, are generally under the age of 6. They're generally reflective of the African-American population in race, so they're majority African-American. A large proportion of them attend some sort of Head Start program, they're just really young kids. So at this point, you know, they are also, sort of sounds terrible to say, a barrier and sometimes very difficult for their parents then, because they are so young, they don't go to school during the day, so the parents also have to worry about childcare if they are going to school or looking for a job or actually going to a job. So these things are also very important to consider in the homeless family population, and they're generally with their mothers. A large, large majority of these homeless families are mothers with 2 to 3 kids. So they also, you know, they have siblings and are in these sort of living situations where either they're in shelters and they've come from oftentimes doubled up or tripled up family situations. As I mentioned earlier, they have a lot. They have more health problems. They're generally born with they're higher percentage of them than the average population are born with low birth weight. Sort of these general poverty indicators that you would expect.
Okay, and another related question to this one, which is a question, a very serious question, and I wish we'd had more time for it. How big a risk is there if you are the mother or the parent of a child and you are homeless? How big a risk are you running that your child is going to be taken away from you by the child welfare authorities?
It's actually a large risk. It depends on the situation. The problem oftentimes is that when a parent, you know, if they become homeless, if they're able to keep their kids together, you know, if they're not able to provide the proper living situation, that may be grounds for their kids to be taken away. A more difficult thing is once the kids are taken away, getting those kids back. Because they, you know, if you, for example, are a mother and you have a girl and a boy, you need to have a three-bedroom apartment, according to often many ACS or Child Welfare Service agencies require that. And, you know, to be able to afford that in many major urban areas, it's very expensive, especially for a single mother. So really that's more of a difficulty in getting kids back once they are already in the child welfare system. And there are certain shelters, I know, even in New York City, where they're actually specifically designed for just such a purpose, so to provide sort of a stable area for the parent to be so that they can, you know, have a foundation in order to be able to get the kids back and then have also housing services and things to get them into private living accommodations.
Those numbers to call in here again on the Homelessness Marathon, anybody can call 877-NOBODY-8. And if you are homeless or formerly homeless or afraid you're about to be homeless, you can also call in on 866-LEFT-OUT. It is at this moment in the show that I must confess that not everybody who is in the tower of testimony to speak at the microphone is equal. Because we have at the mic, well, let me tell you the story. Somebody here at Columbus House is a poet, and we've had many poems read on the marathon tonight. I love it. But somebody is a poet who did not want to read his work on the air. He didn't feel comfortable going on the air. And he asked someone else to read it, who is at the mic, and that person is Ellen, who happens to be my wife. So, therefore, you will understand out there, I hope you understand, this is not a class system. This is the domestic tranquility system. And I am honored to recognize my wife, Ellen, at the mic. Ellen, you want to read a couple of poems for us?
These are two poems by Jimmy.
Jimmy, okay.
The first is called I See. I see a lady dressed in white, taking her morning walk. I see two people greeting each other as they start to talk. I see some people riding their bikes, in cars, and on buses, all heading off to work. I see some people smoking on a blunt. What a jerk. I see a man reading a newspaper and another reading a book. I see a lady playing computer chess. Oops, there goes her rook. I see a FedEx truck hustling right along, trying to make its delivery on time. I see a UPS truck also not very far behind. I see some people walking into City Hall as if it were a shopping mall. Of all those people that I see, I wonder how many of them do see me. This is called A Homeless Dream. People see me every day, yet they don't know who I am. All they see is a homeless person sleeping in the shadows. Some will walk around as if in a daze, wondering if tomorrow will be better than today, never thinking that I was once the same as they are. They don't look into my eyes, my heart, or my soul. If only they knew what was on my mind, they wouldn't look at me so cold. All I ask for is a little respect. Is that too brash or too bold? In my mind, I long for the simple thing, a roof over my head, food in the kitchen, and a job so I wouldn't be homeless again. this is a homeless person dream, but it's a person with a home's nightmare.
Well, my thanks to Jimmy. My thanks to you, Ellen. And if there are any talent agents out there in the audience, just email us and I'll let you know about Ellen's availability for dramatic readings. Those numbers again are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT-DENNIS. You know, if I were a doctor and I was looking at a patient, and you know the way it is modern medicine, they will run a bunch of tests and they're running numbers and there's your sat rate and your bun rate and your this rate. And then the doctor might say, well, look, I'm looking at all these numbers and this is the one that leaps out at me. You know, they'll say, or here we have something that really seems a little out of whack. You look at numbers on homelessness. And when you look at all the numbers, what leaps out at you?
Well, I think that the one thing that over the last 5 years probably that I think we've been able to do the most with, bring the most attention to, is that a relatively small number of people, about 10% of the single adult homeless, are homeless for very, very long periods of time. And really, many of them will never leave homelessness without help from a housing program. And if we shifted our resources, they use about half of the emergency shelter resources. So if we shifted some of those resources to helping them have permanent housing, we would both solve their homelessness problem and reduce the size of the shelter system at the same time.
Now, people have made the point, and would you concur that it's actually cheaper to house people than to shelter them?
It depends on who it is. It's, you know, we estimate that it's about $18,000 a year for a shelter bed. And there are some people who, when they're homeless, they're not only using the shelters, but they're, you know, ending up in hospitals and they're ending up in jail and prison. And certainly for that population, it's cheaper to find them supportive housing, which has a housing subsidy plus services, than it is to have them homeless. But for many other people, they're not homeless all year long. And so they might only be homeless for a month, 2 months, 3 months. And it would not be in the strictly financial, you know, cost benefit to give them a housing subsidy, because many of them will leave on their own and take care of their own housing situation. But, yeah, it is true that for the chronically homeless, it is probably at least a break-even situation to put them in permanent housing.
So there is some population that would be true.
Right.
Okay, at the microphone, we have Tracy. Tracy, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hello. I would like to speak upon the fact that everybody in my life that I know is two paychecks away from being homeless. They're constantly laying off in the state of Connecticut. And I live in New Haven. I'm a single handicapped mother staying at a shelter thinking I could get bumped up the list for like Section 8 housing. I'm on a list. I'm on a list all over Connecticut. But number one I'd like to say is that New Haven is one of the highest tax cities. And I don't know what they do with their money, because I walk by abandoned buildings, areas, and the snow isn't off the sidewalks, there's potholes in the roads, and there's 1,300 homeless people, and you're trying to tell me out of these 13 homeless people that there's not a carpenter, an electrician, a plumber, and about 800 laborers?
Hey, Tracy, I'm not trying to tell you that.
No, no, I'm trying to, you know, maybe the governor will hear this, you
okay.
know, or the mayor of New Haven. But it's sad, you know, and it's cold, and they do kick us out unless it's 32 degrees and lower. But, you know, I've gotten frostbite standing outside just waiting for the bus, and that's how cold it was.
Let me ask you a couple of things. First
sure.
of all, Tracy, how old are you?
I'm 33.
And if you are comfortable talking about it, can you tell us what your disability is?
I have psoriatic arthritis.
Okay, I don't really know what that is.
It's rheumatory.
Okay, so it makes it hard for you to move
yeah.
around and stuff like that. And as a, you said 33?
Yes.
33-year-old mother, how old is your?
My son, Justin, he's 3.
Okay, as a 33-year-old mother of a 3-year-old son with arthritis, meaning you, not your son, Where are you on the waiting list for Section 8?
The bottom.
How many people are ahead of you?
Thousands.
Thousands.
Hundreds.
And so how long...
Maybe not thousands, hundreds.
Hundreds. How long do you think, realistically, have they told you you would have to wait?
I don't know. They just said, well, you're on the list.
But they haven't said, come back next week.
No, no. Months. I've been here for 5 months.
Okay, and you have
and
not
gotten
And I
did all
anything.
The legwork to try to find the places to fill out Section 8. And it's really hard, you mm-hmm. know, when you've got a small income and you can barely put food on the table and the state gives you $10 for food stamps. What is that going to buy?
Well, it's going to buy $10 worth of food, I guess.
Right?
You know, right? Right.
But I eat 30 other days out of the
Month, right?
Nope, okay. Right.
All right. Well, let me talk to my two experts here. Donna, how common have you heard this story? I mean, have you ever heard of anybody else other than Tracy being on a long waiting list?
Oh, my goodness. I think you could ask the entire homeless population in New York City. The waiting lists for Section 8 here are incredibly long, depending on the area, anywhere between 5 and 8 years. So obviously, Section 8 is sort of a difficult voucher to receive, and it's actually become even more difficult for homeless families in New York. The Department of Homeless Services here in the city has recently changed the policy where I think we had previously a policy similar to what it sounds like you have there in New Haven, where families who were in homeless shelters were given top priority, first priority for Section 8 vouchers, and that's actually been changed here now. They're trying to focus the Section 8 vouchers on the working poor. And so now people who are living, families who are living in shelters are no longer eligible actually for Section 8 vouchers. They have a new program now called Housing Stability Plus that is sort of a similar housing subsidy with the exception that the subsidy itself decreases by 20% every year. And so it's only good for 5 years. And families are also only eligible for this Housing Stability Plus voucher if they have a public assistance or welfare case open in the city. So it's remains to be seen how it's actually going to work in, you know, in practice. It's a very new program, but, you know, you can see lots of ways that it could have problems for these families that are just barely getting by the first year, and when they cut that housing voucher by 20% the following year, you know, what happens to them? Are they going to get kicked out of their apartments? Are they going to come back to the shelter system? Or will they be able to supplement their income in some way? It really remains to be seen mm-hmm. what's going to happen to that certain segment of the population.
Dennis, to your knowledge, are there other people besides Tracy who are on these waiting lists who are actually disabled?
Sure. I'm sure there are many who are disabled. Having a disability doesn't make you automatically eligible for a housing subsidy. And in many jurisdictions, it doesn't even get you, you know, any higher priority. So these waiting lists are, in effect, really not functional because there is not the Section 8 subsidies available or the public housing available for people to locate into. They have to hope that someone moves out, basically, because there aren't new units
right.
that are coming online.
Well, you know, every now and then a point comes up I think it's worth underscoring. And, you know, for people out there, a lot of people, good Americans who really believe there is a social safety net in this country, should understand there are disabled people on a waiting list that isn't moving, and they're not getting housing. So I do think that's an important point. Tracy, we're going to have to move along, but I want to give you a chance. Is there more that you would like America to hear?
Well, I wish they didn't have so many abandoned buildings and a lot of us wouldn't be homeless.
Yep, a lot of
people.
And
the fact is that there's a freeze on Section 8 in the town of New Haven. I don't know why. We don't have answers for that. When you got empty buildings and houses and condos to be... Yep.
And they won't even let you go in on your own and fix them up.
No.
And a lot of people have pointed this out.
God forbid you might have bad credit because you're getting a divorce and certain bills didn't get paid. They look at that. Or if you've ever been evicted from an apartment, you're going to be homeless forever.
Well, I hope not. And where are you living right now, Tracy?
In the Columbus House.
Okay. And And is your son with you?
No, that's only for, the place where I could take my son, that's also full.
Where is your son?
He's with my parents.
Okay, but, well, thank God at least your
yes,
son is.
Yes, thank God for good parents.
That you have parents who can take care of your
yes.
son. And we will wish you the very best in terms of getting housing, and we'll hope that somehow magically you're able to move up on that waiting list or something.
Well, when they take the lift off of the Section 8, the freeze, you know, there's nothing I can do.
You know, I must tell you, I think something else is freezing over before they're taking the freeze off of Section 8.
Yeah.
So that's
somebody's lining their pockets.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think this Bush budget is a very helpful one.
I don't
one
know why
this.
We voted for him again.
Well, personally speaking, I didn't, but thank you just
no
the
homeless
same.
Person in the town of New Haven voted for Bush.
There you go. All right, thank you very much.
Drinking the beer instead.
Those numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And on the line, we have Lindsay from Boston. Lindsay, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Oh, hey, I'm really glad that you guys are doing this. This is an essential issue for more people to hear about.
Thank you very much. What would you like to say, Lindsay?
Well, in the Boston area, the Boston and Brookline housing authorities have so-called combined, so that the cap, too, the cap as in how much money they are willing to pay or let you pay for an apartment have melded together. In other words, in Brookline, where it would have cost you $300 more to get a one- or two-bedroom apartment to live in with your child, has now been reduced to what it was in Boston. So essentially, they're forcing in Brookline all of the Section 8 people out. And the homelessness and poverty rate in Brookline Village has actually gone up, although this is something that hasn't been really noticed by too many people, but I actually did a census study between 1990 and 2000. The poverty rate has gone up, and yet small businesses are being forced out. Artists are being forced out. Those people who really brought the community up are the ones who are now unable to afford to live here, and I happen to be an artist and on a housing authority voucher, and so that's why, you know, I can see these trends, but I also wrote a half-hour radio play about homelessness that mm-hmm. we aired as a live webcast in July, and I believe the woman Ellen, who was reading the dramatic read before, was our lead player. I don't know, her voice sounded awfully alike.
No, I can tell you, it's a different person, but nonetheless, all those casting agents out there do take note. Lindsay, when we did actually the fourth marathon, we did from Cambridge.
Yeah.
And one of the things people talked about was that the Section 8 voucher was so unrealistic in terms of the rent in the area that the only way you could get a housing was to live so far out of Boston that you could no longer get a job. Have you heard anything along these lines?
Yes, well, that's basically, yes. That's basically what's been happening is that the criterion are so difficult to fit into and that the caps are so high. In other words, it used to be that Brookline would say, okay, you can find an apartment, a one-bedroom apartment for, or I would have to have a two-bedroom apartment with my son. I've been a single mother for, 24 years. He just graduated from college, so I'm fortunate in that regard. But the Brookline Housing Authority now says, well, you don't need a two-bedroom. You don't need $1,200 to pay for a one-bedroom. Well, the thing is, the rents have gone up. So you can't
right.
find a place that the housing authority will say is okay to live in. Then they'll come and inspect it if you can afford it, and they'll say, oh, well, this isn't fit to live in. You can't live here.
Right.
Then
right.
the landlord will say, well, geez, you know, I have to raise the rent. And the housing authority will say, you can't raise the rent. And then it'll force, you know, people like me out, which is what is happening now.
Dennis, has anybody ever done a study on how many areas, I mean, what percentage of the people who are even getting a Section 8 voucher are actually able to use it in the housing market that they're in?
Sure. I think that about 80% of the certificates are used on their first round. It's called the turnback rate, mm-hmm. And it does vary from city to city. So, I do not know I couldn't say precisely what the answer is to that, but yes, there is a percentage of certificates that get turned back because people cannot find apartments that would rent at that level, as your caller is indicating.
You get 6 months or something, is that it, to use it?
I am not, again, that would be a matter of local policy, actually, the
okay.
length of time that you have to try to find that unit. That would be governed by the local housing authorities.
There's also the stigmatization of people who go to find a place and say, oh, yeah, I have a voucher, which basically means that the landlord is guaranteed a certain percentage of rent, which is actually, you know, a good thing for them. But because of that stigmatization that, oh, this person is an under-income person, it puts us in a place where, well, you know, gee, we don't want to rent to her. She might try to tear the windows out, or, you know, she might bring a rat infestation in or something. It's kind of a ridiculous, I don't even want to say myth, because it's not like it's a metaphor, but it's a lie in terms of, you know, people who are out selling spare change, the newspaper, those people are wonderful, awesome people who have lots of talents and a great history, like many of the people that you had talked to before, say the man John from California, who had been in the finance area before. But we look at those people who are selling spare change for a dollar as if, you know, there's some kind of odd growth, and we pass them by, and we don't want to hear about it. And public radio stations, which, I mean, public is not really the right word for it anymore, but many of those radio stations where we used to think that we would hear about these issues in a broader and more well-rounded way are not willing to bring this issue out because people don't want to look at it. They don't want to see it in their own backyard. They don't want to know that this high rate of homelessness exists, that these children are out there freezing, that these mothers can't be with their children because they can't find a place to live together.
Well, I'm not going to touch the line about the radio stations. I've been very outspoken about radio stations in this country, but I'm trying to be good because maybe they'll pick up the marathon, you know. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut except to say that those Boston NPR stations are really scurrilous. I guess I didn't keep my mouth shut enough. But never mind. The bigger the NPR station, the less sensitive it is likely to be to poor people's issues. But I have to also say there's a lot of good people working in radio, on NPR. So I won't put them down completely because, a lot of them are carrying the marathon and a lot of them really do want to do the right thing. So.
Well, it's all about the individuals, too.
Yes.
So just as individuals are homeless and can't be generalized as a scurrilous lot,
Neither
can the radio stations be generalized because there are individuals like you and those who have put this show on that bring these issues out, and that's what
I'm so glad you're a more temperate person than I am. So thank you very much for your contribution to the marathon.
Thanks for being there.
Those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8, 866-LEFT-OUT. We got James from Ithaca on the line. James, you there? Did we lose James? Okay, James seems to be gone, but that's okay. I'm sorry we lost James, but we've got Judy here at the tower. So, Judy, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
And good morning, and thank you for being here. We really much appreciate that.
Well, it's my pleasure.
But I think a couple of the key words here are housing and change. Too much emphasis has been placed on this whole thing is on alcoholism and psychiatric disorders. And what Tracy previously said, all the buildings that are empty here, particularly here in New Haven, will come here, pay the homeless a decent wage, fix them up, and give them some housing.
Whoa, well, there's a radical idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this comes up every now and then, too, right? And again,
and
it's about having the will to do it.
Change has to be nationwide. And the legislators got to stop the local, state, local, and federal government have got to stop dragging their feet on this issue.
Just hang on a second, Judy. Donna, I want to ask you something, because
sure.
Judy's saying here there's too much emphasis on alcoholism and stuff. What percentage, Donna, you're an expert on the children, what percentage of the homeless children are alcoholics?
I actually do. There are, from a study that we did back in 1999, we did a national study of homeless populations, and from that survey, we did find that about 3% of kids 12 years of age or older, so
right.
that between 12 and 18%, are using illicit drugs or alcohol. So we're talking about a fairly small percentage, but still, like any percentage in that age group is awful. But
is that higher or lower than the general population of 12 and over?
I don't know what the actual general population. I only have that number for the survey of the homeless population that we did.
Okay. What about the kids 6 and under? What percentage of them are alcoholics?
I'm gonna hazard a guess that it's much less than 1%, and you know, maybe including babies who are born already addicted to some sort of substance.
Okay, so when we talk about homeless people being addicted and all of that, This is ignoring the fact that an enormous percentage are children who don't even fit into that category
exactly.
to begin with.
All exactly. right.
Just wanted to establish that for the record.
Yeah. And I actually just wanted to respond to something that Judy said. I think she brought up a great point.
She's standing right there.
About the living wage and the fact that the minimum wage in this country is at the federal level at such a low rate that if a person, a parent with a child or two, works full-time at a minimum wage job, their salary, their annual salary, is below the U.S. poverty level. So even someone who's working full-time, trying to make it work, trying to support their kids, they can't make a decent living working a minimum wage job. So until, I mean, there's sort of some structural problems, and until that minimum wage is raised, a lot of these, you know, these low-income workers are just going to have an even tougher time trying to survive and to support their families.
Judy, I'm going to ask you for your opinion about something, which I don't think anybody can answer this really, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because, you know, it's a kind of common sense approach. We got empty houses, we got people needing jobs, put two and two together, right? Let's put people to work building housing. Why isn't that happening?
Because the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer.
Well, I can't
and
really
I just
argue with
people,
that.
The person that's on the phone was stating that minimum wage jobs, well, most of those minimum wage jobs are Wendy's, McDonald's, Burger King, okay? And to stop paying benefits, they don't even get in full-time hours, okay? I worked for those companies on my way up to
becoming.
Well,
that's not an accident. They don't want you working full-time because they don't want you getting those benefits.
Right, so they don't pay benefits, all right? People can't survive even on minimum wage.
Well,
okay, working 40 hours a week.
Let's remember there's always hope because there's Walmart.
Okay.
Never mind.
Tracy said there's one section of town that there's got to be at least 300 abandoned apartments, okay? Hire the homeless, okay? Give them a decent living wage. Train them.
We once had somebody who also pointed out you don't even have to displace union workers because they can be the ones who teach homeless people how to do the jobs. Well, never mind. Common sense, if common sense got you anywhere in America, well, I don't know how to finish that sentence. I guess if common sense got you any place, I wouldn't be out here all night in the cold. And
we
you wouldn't be
that.
There. Thank you very much, Judy.
Okay, I have one additional thing that I want to say about the government. The government's trying to cut out Section 8.
Yep.
It's trying to screw up Social Security. I'm on Social Security now. I am fully disabled. I worked for 40-some-odd years, okay? I can no longer work anymore.
No, you misunderstand. They're going to save Social Security.
And it was because I got ill that I became homeless.
Yeah, they're going to save Social Security.
And
that's what they tell us.
But we need help, and the government's got to stop dragging their feet. And the rich, like I said, they just get rich off of us.
All right. It's getting really late, so I will mention, by the way, I did run for Congress, and I lost. But my own tax policy was soak the rich, and I will stand behind that. So thank you very much, Judy.
Thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Okay, Mac from Lincoln, Nebraska, are you there?
Yes, I am. Are you there?
Yes, I am. What's on your mind, Mac?
Oh, boy. I hope, well, number one, I'm very, very proud to be calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. KZUM is our local station.
Good for KZUM.
I couldn't believe it when I cranked up on it last night. Mm-hmm. Well, you hit it just so right on with this living wage thing. You just hit it so right on with the lady that was just on about being able to work for a living wage. This is where the real problem is. I'm living right now several paychecks. I've just been disemployed, and I'm several paychecks away from being out on the street, and it's not a good feeling. Been living, served my country, living in a substandard place here for the last, oh, I'll say 36 years, 37 years. Survived, proud, helped, and here we go. And boy, the lady with the idea there on the houses that are sitting empty, the businesses that are sitting empty, things can be done with it. Hey, I think you just got me fired up. We're going to start getting out, getting with some people. Get things going from the inside. I don't know any other way.
Hang on a second. Anyway. Hang on. Dennis.
Yeah.
Do we know what percentage of workers in America do not make a living wage?
Tons.
Well, I would say
it's something on the, or you know, again, I don't know maybe the national statistics. I do know that in Philadelphia, about 20% of our population makes less than, or 25% makes less than $20,000 a year. And that would be roughly where I would draw that living wage line.
Mm-hmm. Donna, do you have any information about that in New York?
From the recent research that I've been doing just with the census data, it's about that. It's about 20 to 25% of the population.
So, again, we're talking about working poor, and about 20 to 25% of the people who are working in this country are not getting paid enough to live on. Mac, that's your situation, right?
Well, yeah, not only that, but you see, people, you back there on the East Coast, hey, everybody, if anybody around Brunswick, Maine is listening, hi up there. I spent a couple years up there at the Brunswick Naval Air Station. But out here in Nebraska, we have another little problem. Where I grew up, we used to have a family that was able to have a good living on a section of land. That's a mile by a mile. Now, we're down to the people in Nebraska. You talked about small farms. You're talking about something 20 miles by 20 miles.
That's because it's all agribusiness now.
You got it.
Right. And genetic engineering, that's another thing I'm very much opposed to. But
Get out of here.
Uh-oh. Can't I stay?
No, that is terrible stuff.
Yeah, I'm a big opponent of that, but this is not the time to discuss it. But you raise a lot of good issues, Mac. I wish I had more time for you, but I want to move along because we got a lot of people who want to get in on this.
Hey, I'm sorry that you have a lot of people that want to get in on this, but I'm glad that you have a lot of people that want to get in on this.
Well put. Thank you very much, Mac.
You're good now.
Yep. Okay, on the line we have Vicky calling from the Auburn State Prison in New York. Vicky, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hello.
Hi, Vicky. You're not an inmate, however, though, right?
No, I'm not an inmate. I'm a psychiatric social worker, and I work for Auburn. I'm actually calling on my own time. I'm not calling from the prison.
Okay.
I wanted to speak about how we contribute to the homeless population by the improper use of the penal system, basically. My experience at Auburn has been that frequently our discharge plan for releasing a prisoner involves giving $30 when they walk out the door and sending them to a homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm. Is that legal, by the way? In some states, that's not legal. Is that legal in New York?
Apparently, it is legal in New York because I sure have seen it happen a large number of times.
Well, when we were in Ohio, they had seen it happen a large number of times. But even a parole officer on the show said it's not legal in Ohio under the law.
Well, if I might.
Please.
If you are being paroled, you have to have you have to have arrangements for work and for a place to live. But the fact is, many people are not being paroled today. They leave prison having completed their sentence, okay?
Exactly.
Because they're mandatory minimum sentences. So people are not eligible for parole, and they leave the system without ever reaching parole status.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, what you get is the, you know, one-way bus ticket, a change of clothes, and $50. And that is not atypical. That's actually, it varies from state to state, but it's essentially the same thing. And
yeah.
Many, many of these people, you know, probably as many as 15% of these people go directly to a homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is one of the uses of homeless shelters. We were talking about that much earlier in the night, and probably nobody listening now was listening then. Mm-hmm. Vicky,
we want to reduce recidivism, and we want very
right.
much for them to not go back to a life of crime. But we have discharged them into an environment with absolutely no job skills whatsoever, sent them to a homeless shelter, given them $40, and said good luck.
Vicky, here's another related question, though. A lot of people say we're locking up too many people in this country. Without getting into the specifics of what is a crime and, you know, what should or should not be a crime, if we were just going to ask you, you know, you meet all these prisoners, and if you just had to say, well, if I was going to ask you, what percentage of these people really, really need to be locked up to protect society, what would your answer be?
Well, there's a large number of people that I work with that are basically mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
They are not necessarily criminal. They are just extremely mentally ill. And given in the state of New York that we now have 19,000 people in prison and less than 5,000 people in mental institutions, the money has been shifted from mental health care to incarceration. Mm-hmm. So we've basically taken people out of the institutions where they used to receive mental health care, and now we've put them in prison.
So you're here to say that actually a lot of these people could be better served, society could be better served some other way.
Oh, they could very much be better served with mental health services than they could be by being in prison.
All right. We're almost out of time, and I want to just try and get another person or two in, so I want to thank you very much, Vicki, for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have someone at the mic at the tower there, George at the mic.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind, George?
I want to talk about the application process when you go out to apply for apartments and stuff like that there. They have a process where, you know what I'm saying, sometimes they might charge you like a application fee to find out, like, if you have a criminal record or something like that there, something that might have happened to you 5, maybe 10 years ago, and they still hold that against you. And some of us, like, we don't have proper credit, and that makes it hard for us to get apartments too. And then, like, when they do the application process, then they come back and tell you that you're not eligible for the apartment, but you don't get that application fee back. You know what I'm saying? Most of us are homeless, and we can't afford to be getting up to $50, $60 that they charge, you know what I'm saying, for them to do a background check on you. And I think it's kind of wrong, you know what I'm saying, because, I mean, we're all human beings, and everybody here needs some place to stay. And without us having proper credit, or they're holding our records and stuff against us, leaves us still out there in the cold. Therefore, we don't have opportunity to get an apartment or put a roof right here.
I hear you.
And I wish that they would please, like, at least give us a chance, because we're human, and we all make mistakes. You know what I'm saying? But we're trying to make amends to our mistakes, but we all need some place to stay.
No, you know, if there was a surplus of housing, this wouldn't be happening.
Exactly.
All right. Well, listen, we got to move along, George. Okay. I wish I had more time for you, but
okay.
I want to thank you.
Thank you very much.
Donna, let me ask you something here. You're the Institute for Children in Poverty. What are your recommendations for getting children out of poverty and out of homelessness?
It's just basically getting people off the street, out of shelters, getting people trained and letting them and showing them the way or helping them to be able to survive on their own. So, you know, if it takes education of the parents, if it takes after-school programs for kids, if it takes Section 8 vouchers, if it takes preventative measures such as exactly as the previous gentleman was just saying, you know, assistance to people who are trying to get housing, oftentimes it's very difficult to save up for first and last month's rent and all the extra fees when you're trying to get an apartment. So, you know, more assistance for people who, you know, would be able to afford it but just can't get the upfront cost together. So more attention on, kids and the measures to help them, because they really are not able to help themselves. And, you know, getting them out of the system and hopefully on their way so that they won't repeat it, because we're seeing that pattern now where people who sort of grew up in the shelter system, grew up in the foster care system, are having kids and doing the same thing. So we're
okay,
trying to...
Okay, we're almost out of time. Professor Culhane, what is the Culhane plan for getting people out of homelessness?
Well, I think it's twofold. One is working with people who do have disabilities and who are chronically homeless and helping them get into housing with support services. And then the other is providing, possibly through the tax system, some credit to people for the housing market rents that they're paying, something like the earned income tax credit, that would get people who are low-wage workers some assistance in meeting the cost of their housing. Some combination of those things is likely to be needed.
All right. We are out of time, so let me just say Dennis Culhane, Professor of Social Welfare Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, and Donna Anderson, Director of the Institute for Children in Poverty in New York, I want to thank you both very much for being my co-hosts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. And
we're
going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with WPKN Community Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating or affiliated radio stations. To view the webcast of this broadcast, order tapes, or contact nobody after the show, go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org.